Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the March 25th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist, the host of the Capital Record podcast, and the author of Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life, and of course, the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. David, hello.
Hello, Will. Welcome back from Germany.
Thanks, man. I come back and you are everywhere. Like, what's your schedule like today and tomorrow?
Dallas, Texas. I speak at an Acton Institute event about the new book. And then I do a big client event in Dallas, Texas. I think we have like 65 of our Dallas-Fort Worth clients coming for a talk about the investment markets and Federal Reserve and macroeconomic conditions. It's pretty much the most fun you can have. I mean, it's going to be great. And then we got the same thing going in Houston and the same thing going in Austin.
I love it. Well, thanks for making the time to talk with us here. Let's start immediately with Gavin Newsom's open letter to California's Muslim, Palestinian American, and Arab American communities.
Yes.
This is a really remarkably odd letter, David. It's, first of all, it's just very lengthy, relies on very little evidence that there's anti-Muslim attacks going on in California. In fact, what he really says here is that it pains him so deeply to see the ways in which these communities are suffering, bearing the weight of lost family and friends in Gaza while facing a rise in discrimination and hate here at home. So yeah. On one hand, I'm with him in feeling for people who have family in Gaza right now. That has to be horrific. God bless those people. On the other hand, his attempt to link it to some sort of problem here at home, as he calls it, is bizarre. He offers just two examples here at home. One is a situation in Chicago in which a child was stabbed to death by a guy who appears to be insane, and who, after October 7th, attacked this poor child, this kid, with a knife. That's one of Gavin Newsom's examples of why he needs to step into the fray here. And the other one is, he says, here in California, too, we've seen bigotry rear its ugly head. He cites just one example, David. In November, an Arab Muslim student at Stanford University was injured in a hit and run by a driver who is alleged, keyword, to have shouted hateful vitriol as he sped away. These are not isolated incidents, he says, but he cites no others. That's that rhetorical trick of saying, I could go on, but there's just so many examples and you know them. But an allegation of anti-Semitism in a hit-and-run accident in Palo Alto is, to me at least, a long distance from we've got to have the governor step in immediately and do something about these metastasizing attacks on the Arab Muslim communities in California.
Yeah, so what do you think is going on? Why would he be doing this? What is his motivation?
Well, I was hoping maybe you could shed some light on that. My own sense is that he's trying to be on both sides of the issue. There's a lot of both sidesism in here. Buried in this piece is a single sentence that refers to his objection to the October 7th attacks by Hamas on Israelis. But that's it. So there's a little bit of the Joe Biden thing going on here, I think, where it's we've got to at least protest our defense of Israel's right to defend itself. But on the other hand, oh, my gosh, let's pay attention to the progressive left and their high anxiety, and I would argue their anti-Semitism. One could go down through the news search in California and find, I think, far more serious attacks on Jews after October 7th. And, you know, I'm not just talking about speech acts of hate. I'm talking about actual physical attacks on people who appear to have been Jewish, wearing a yarmulke. They look Jewish for some other reason. I don't know. Maybe they were rich. Whatever fits your stereotype if you're a Nazi. But that seems to be the far graver threat to people if the governor wants to step into this and really protect somebody.
There's only two possibilities for me. Okay, so you can tell me which one and I'm going to believe you. And if there's a third possibility, it just means I'm losing my touch. But I don't think I am. I think there's only two possibilities. One is that he's losing his touch. That this is just a politically odd, silly move. I'm not super prone to believe that. It's not impossible, but it's not Occam's razor to me. But one possibility is that he's losing his touch. The other possibility is that he's putting it out there as limited downside to him politically in doing it, with a potential upside where if Biden falls down some stairs, Newsom could step in with a little bit of a leg up in that, you know, Somali, Michigan, Hamas, Palestinian, Minnesota demographic in which they think Biden could lose 100,000 votes. Mm-hmm. In other words, Newsom is just playing to a demographic that he could get a leg up on Biden with if Biden were to go out.
I think that's it. I think that's that latter is the only explanation, that it looks to me like he really is just riding Biden's coattails here, or shadowing him, if you will, on this.
Biden's vulnerable with that demographic, allegedly. Mm-hmm. And so I think Newsom's trying to say, like, if something is a shakeout where I'm going to go get delegates at the convention and Biden's not the guy, let's get me in front of this.
Mm-hmm. Agree. Yeah, I also don't think it's the 100. I hear this repeatedly, 100,000 votes in some Arab American communities in Michigan. And I think the far greater threat is millennials, the progressive left in general. And Biden has always been vulnerable there on the progressive left. You know, he is seen as a moderate, a guy who used to be, you know, for public safety before he was against it, et cetera. So, I think you've got it exactly right. Just more evidence of the shadow campaign that the governor is running in order to step in should, as you say, Biden fall. A related story here that I thought was fascinating, if you want to talk about, you know, real acts of racism and bigotry, it's the anti-Semitism that arose at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, which is a San Francisco museum. Yerba Buena, of course, being the name of San Francisco before it became San Francisco, means good herb for those of our friends who are into the legalization of marijuana. And I find this fascinating, David, this story, because what happened here is that artists who had their work curated in this museum in San Francisco, again, a city, county-run museum in San Francisco, decided after October 7th that what their art really needed was some political updating to reflect the Israel's response to the October 7th attacks. And this was decidedly, again, from this progressive left. At one point, many of the artists and others issued an open letter declaring that the museum needed to purge itself of Zionists. And, you know, whether those were benefactors or people on the board of the museum director, a CEO, eventually left. So the museum closed when all these artists began demanding that their art be updated. They said, you know, it was their art, their free speech that was at stake here. And the museum has recently opened and apparently agreed to allow the artists to continue their kind of pro-Palestine, anti-Israel messaging in their art. And I guess I find this interesting, David, not because it's a nutpicking event, but because it I think sort of provides counter evidence to Gavin Newsom's claim that the real danger here is anti-Muslim attacks, of which you could identify just one. I think it's also, what's the role of government, if any, in managing art. Like, this has always annoyed me. You know, the fights from my youth, you remember these, I'm sure, from the 90s and the even the 80s, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts. Government funding for art is a kind of government funding for speech. If art is speech, and of course it is, then, you know, why is the government stepping into this stuff and promoting art? First of all, just kind of my libertarian impulse is get government out of the business of promoting art. It's just not government's job. Leave that to the art patrons if you want, and graffiti artists, I guess. But what do you think, David?
Well, I certainly agree. I don't understand why the government gets involved in this stuff. And I also don't know what the motivation of the people who want them to get in it is. I mean, you mentioned the youth is a bigger issue than the Michigan-Palestinian vote with a guy like Biden. Mm. And part of me just wonders if there's a general vibe right now that the youth are kind of aligned on a certain side and that there's sort of a street cred. And that ties into the arts. Right. Like you know, there's a long history of culture being very monolithic. And ironically, since the 1960s, a lot of this is in the name of nonconformity.
That's right.
So iconoclastic art seems to me to be a thing of the past. It's very conformist. It's very first of all, it's also very unimpressive and cheap and lowbrow and uninteresting. So whether you're talking about music, I always get kicked because I love going to Broadway shows. I've gone to Broadway shows as long as I've been a part of New York. I think the theater is a lot of fun. My wife and I have seen a lot of shows. I'll go to shows by myself. When our kids were little, we'd take them to some of the musicals and stuff. But I think it is unbelievable how cliche these supposedly daring, bold theatrical artists are in just saying the exact same thing that every one of them are saying, some form of LGBTQ, some transgender message. It is just a woke, but it's like a woke skit or a woke commentary that I would do if I were making fun of it. Like if it was like a Saturday Night Live kind of thing, it is satire that is totally serious. And that's what's become of the artists. So this Yorba Linda thing, to me, it's all just on the cheap. And then what the reason is for government getting involved, I think you and I probably highlighted it in our prior segment.
Yeah, I think this opens up such a great subject. You and I have talked about this on mic and off. We were both involved in the music scene. And I was especially a punk rocker because I think, you know, Andy Warhol's great line that there was nothing more bourgeois than the fear of seeming bourgeois. So you act in transgressive ways and you say things that are designed to shock. You know, it was kids in the punk rock movement in L.A. in the late 70s, early 80s wearing swastika armbands and, you know, heavy boots and that sort of thing and army jackets that were torn up and hating war and imperialism. All of that stuff was just a commodity. It really was, as Gramsci would have called it, the fetishization of these commodities. And the fetish was, I'm not middle class. I'm an outlier. I'm a renegade. I'm an outsider. And I think you're right, that a lot of this stuff is just prepackaged junk thought. It's not even really thought. It's just sort of a genuflection toward anything that antagonizes the middle class, which I think has just, you know, kind of been part of the American art scene for almost 100 years now.
Yeah. It warrants ongoing coverage where we find these examples. But the truth is, I mean, it's just common. So the question, I would like to see exceptions to that rule, right? Because this type of stuff is the new rule.
Right.
And I think that they're all full of it.
Yeah, the truly transgressive thing today is to stand up for America, to stand up for a strong American defense. This is truly transgressive.
Or to stand up for Jesus, or to stand up for marriage. I don't know, anything traditional. There's clever ways to do it.
Yeah, I had to put this in. I wish I'd put this in the show notes, but there was a story out of Clovis this past week where a group of quote unquote parents, unidentified because they were so fearful, were upset that a Christian group on a high school campus was offering pizza at lunch for the Christian club. So the kids would come in, get, you know, pray, learn about Jesus and eat pizza. And they regarded this as an outrage. Never mind that California public schools have embedded in their guidelines the requirement that they lie to parents about their children's activities around sex. So, okay to talk about sex, okay to talk about, you know, how you need to transition yourself at a high school, but not okay to talk about Jesus. Truly transgressive. Let's move on because I know you're limited on time today. Here's the headline from our own Attorney General Rob Bonta, his press office. Attorney General Rob Bonta files lawsuit against Apple. Smartphone monopolization has stifled innovation and resulted in higher prices for consumers. Here's the quote from the Attorney General. Apple's anti-competitive conduct intentionally leaves consumers bearing the cost of sky-high smartphone prices at a time when smartphones are now essential to so much of our day-to-day lives. He protests the anti-competitive process of Apple in insulating itself from competition. So I've not heard our Attorney General or our governor ever praise markets, but here they are, full-throated Hayekians, delighted by the market process and only intent on restoring real competition to the markets. This is just part of the state attorneys general cooperating with the Biden administration Department of Justice and going after Apple. So, David, I don't know if you've had a whole lot of time to even think about what's going on with Apple. The lawsuit just strikes me as sort of, again, performative in the extreme.
Yeah, I want to be clear. This is Bonta jumping onto what the DOJ is doing. He's not leading the way. A handful of state attorney generals jumped on. And that's a little different. And this is a bunk case. It is nonsense. But I want Radio Free California listeners that are used to Will Swain being the only one who ever drops a little California history knowledge to hear from me a blast from the past.
Will there be John Sutter?
Bill Lockyer.
Yeah.
Who led the way in the Microsoft antitrust case of the late 90s and early 2000s that resulted in an embarrassing loss for California and got to a point where a verdict was handed down that the California taxpayers would be paying Microsoft's legal bills if the state attorney general didn't knock it off. And the idea that adding a free web browser into all the other services that you offer was bad for consumers.
Yes.
never really quite made sense, adding free toys. And the notion that, like, their search engine, you know, they were just bundling this. And what would consumers ever do if they had a free web browser for Microsoft, Internet Explorer, that was also bundled in for free with their operating system? And it's just unbelievable how easily individuals on their own chose to use Google Chrome or other browsers they liked better than IE, never did use Bing, Microsoft search engine much, continued to use Excel and Word and Microsoft Office. The ability of consumers to go cherry pick and Mr. Potato Head the various, you know, available options in the marketplace was unbelievable. Now, there's things I don't like that Apple's doing, and there's things that are, there are other areas where I think they are going to be a little bit more vulnerable, but this is not one of them. And I think that we do face a time where consumers will not continue to pay the prices that are growing around Apple's hardware. But that's what the DOJ case said, is that they have gotten too big. And there's no evidence at all of the consumer not liking it. They have an option much cheaper than an iPhone with an Android, and they obviously don't like it, don't do it. And then, yes, Apple provides a whole lot of ancillary revenue embedded into your ownership of an iPhone with various apps and subscriptions that will make for a more convenient consumer experience, but also pay Apple a whole bunch of money. So for Bonta to jump onto this shouldn't be a surprise. I think most of the blue state governors did. And I just want to be clear that this is a California following a bad thing, not California leading a bad thing. Where Bill Lockyer in the 90s, he got his ass handed to him. And that was an embarrassing case of government overreach with Apple, excuse me, a Microsoft and Lockyer in the, I think it was filed in 99. And then this Apple deal with Bonta, they're really following DOJ, which is getting one embarrassment after the other. Linda Kahn at FTC, a lot of these antitrust blockages of various mergers and acquisitions have been failing in court. So it's worth watching. This is a very interventionist Biden administration. And we all know Rob Bonta is a very interventionist attorney.
There's something really remarkable about this. Maybe you can help me just tease it out quickly. But it's part of Bonta's argument is that Apple has been successful and its success has made the iPhone indispensable, or at least smartphones indispensable to everyday life. Yeah. And so it's a little bit like if innovation doesn't work, whatever. But if it does work and people adopt it in big numbers, if people adopt a technology or a service in big numbers, then the government must step in because now that product or service has become essential to daily life, Bonta tells us. And that's the government's gateway into, so therefore we need to regulate it. It's a little bit like, you know, Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash get wildly successful and the government decides what's really needed, therefore, is to allow the people who came to work for this successful company to now really own it and manage it in some very real sense.
Yeah, I think that the general class warfare side of just success is bad and whatnot, that's always kind of there on the left. But this is more specific in a legal sense. And it does come down to a Robert Bork doctrine that by definition, antitrust requires a damaged consumer, not a benefited consumer. And Linda Kahn and the new left, their dogma on antitrust, which Bonta is obviously buying into, is that size in and of itself is anti-competitive. And that we just have a century of modern economic precedent that are counterfactuals.
Big story that just came out late last week. Here's the headline from the Pensions and Investments news site. The headline is CalPERS strongly opposes ballot measure that could kill pension funding. So just to remind our listeners, CalPERS is the California Public Employee Retirement System. That is the government system that manages pension funds for the government's employees. And a spokesperson, CalPERS held a big vote last week, huge open debate and a hearing. I shouldn't say it was an open debate. It was stacked by government union representatives and members of unions who came to tell CalPERS that they needed to stop an initiative that is headed for the ballot in November, brought by a bunch of free market friends of yours and mine, David. And so let me back up just one step and say this ballot initiative in November, which is called the Taxpayer Protection and Government Accountability Act, would amend the California Constitution to change the rules for how state and local governments can impose taxes, fees, and other charges. The argument is, quite simply, that government can't just by a simple majority vote go out and declare that other people's money can be taken from them in order to provide pension fund dollars in California. So let me back up even further still. I know this is getting really complicated and weedy, but government unions, as I've said before, help finance the campaigns of politicians who get into office and then raise our taxes. Why do they raise our taxes? Because government unions want higher pay and benefits, earlier retirements, for example, for all of their members. That's the product those unions deliver. The politicians are simply a way of helping them achieve that by imposing taxes and increased bond debt. And so this act would say, you can't do that anymore. You can't just raise fees, raise taxes, and increase debt without getting certain standards in place, like a two-thirds majority of the legislature approving it. Well, CalPERS says, oh my gosh, this would really just make it impossible for us to pay down this unfunded pension liability, these obligations we have to government workers and their retirements. But the fact is, these are the same politicians who've made this system unsustainable in the first place. They go out and they guarantee higher wages and benefits, and then they go to the taxpayers and say, it sucks to be you, but you're going to pay for these higher wages and benefits. And now some taxpayer groups are saying, no, enough. We're not going to do this anymore. Get us off the merry-go-round. So I know I've done a terrible job, David, of setting this up, but go ahead and, you know, you've had a lot to say about how the system is unsustainable for really important reasons. What do you make of this latest claim by CalPERS?
Well, I find CalPERS' role in all this to be morally hideous. That, you know, a lot of people on the right will criticize CalPERS for saying, for underperformance, for being bad at what they do. And my theory has always been, well, I expect them to be bad at what they do. It's too big, it's too bureaucratic, and they're never going to be able to recruit the A-team of portfolio management talent. But yet I've also always said, when friends of mine on the right were screaming that their biggest problem was assuming a discount rate in the performance of the portfolio, in the actuarial assumptions, that was too high. And I've always said, you can tell the computer 7 instead of 8% if you want. And you can write a big article trying to be smug when they have a year that they're down 5 instead of up 7. But every pension fund and every insurance fund has assumptions in actuarial tables of blended averages, not getting there year over year over year. And so by us going after that, we're missing the main issue, which is underfunding. I've always wanted to go after the pension funds for underfunding. CalPERS has refused to be honest about what has really created the unfunded liability. So I think it's outrageous. And their role, and then your point about the conflict of interest in the pension money that they, the union money they take. I think that that lack of transparency, that highly conflicted model, at that point, I rejoin my friends on the right in believing that the whole system is insidious.
It's terrible, David. You know what you see, I mean, just to take break it down to kind of the your local school district or your local city council, they cut deals. These public officials who have been elected by the public, but typically in campaigns that were financed by government unions, get up on the dais and vote for an increase in pay. That increase in pay will immediately trigger more debt, because that local agency, whether it's a school district or the city council or whatever, will have to pay a new percentage, or not a new percentage, but more money into the pension system to account for the higher wage in retirement. And so what's remarkable here about this to me is that these people who keep making these terrible deals with government unions and then continue to underfund the system, then blame the taxpayers for not wanting to pay the check that these people have written. And here's the...
But can I just say, please. I mean, they actually said this would hinder their ability, it would weaken the financial stability. This is a quote from the CalPERS board member in the article you're putting in the show notes, Lisa Middleton. It would significantly weaken the financial stability of every city and every county in the state of California. If what? What would? If they had to have the money to spend that they're spending?
Yes.
So there's greater financial stability to be allowed to spend money you don't have?
That's right.
What a back-asswards thing to say.
Well, and that's exactly right, David. This is it. They first go out and create the obligation to pay more into CalPERS and then come to the taxpayers and say, we don't have enough money. Now we're unstable. We need to raise taxes. And if they can't raise taxes, then they are forced to cut city services, and you have what's called service-level bankruptcy in these government agencies. I love that. I'll put this in the show notes. John Kupal of Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association is writing about a separate effort by Gavin Newsom, Rob Bonta, and a bunch of government unions who are suing to keep this taxpayer initiative off the ballot in November. Their complaint, John notes, in their filing says, the governor and the legislature's attorneys have complained that the Taxpayer Protection Act reduces the legislature's spending power and increases the power of state and local voters to reject taxes. To which we responded, Kupal says, yeah, that's the point.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on.
But I mean, I want to point out that this has become a trick in every area. The Social Security system. Some people like me will say, hey, we're going to have to adjust the way we're doing this to keep it solvent. And then someone will go, oh, you want to come in and mess with it and threaten its stability.
Right.
I'll say, no, there's only one thing in front of us right now that messes with its stability, and that's not doing anything. And so but that's a pretty effective campaign. I would argue that Donald Trump is hideously guilty of doing the same yes. thing that the left has been doing, accusing those that want to turn knobs with the economics to make it sustainable of being the ones who want to threaten its sustainability. It's gaslighting in a textbook definition way.
Yeah. So with all this news of financial instability created, I would argue, by the people who are opposed to any kind of reform in the pension system, by Rob Bonta writing the coattails of the Biden administration into war with Apple, it's hardly a surprise that California's unemployment rate continues to rise. It is now the highest in the U.S., according to recent reports. Here's from, I think this is from the San Francisco Chronicle's story about the subject. Headline, California unemployment rate rises to highest level in U.S. California's unemployment rate rose to 5.3% in February, the highest among all U.S. states. California's unemployment rate was up 0.1 percentage points from January, surpassing Nevada. National unemployment rate, by the way, was 3.9%, a two-year high. So, David, I've been asked a couple of times this morning already on radio and by a couple of journalists, you know, what's behind these numbers. I've tried to explain some of the things that you and I have talked about, the sort of the underlying corruption in this system, but specifically, I know you hate this phrase, and I can't think of a better one, our government establishment, our political establishment, our willingness to go after business people all the time, to regulate them, to raise minimum wages through AB 257, for example, in the fast food industry, or to eliminate the right to work independently under Assembly Bill 5, all the regulations surrounding all the hirings and firings and detailed activities of any corporation in California. This is not a state that welcomes business. And so we have driven out major corporations and many of our wealthy into other states. And so seeing the unemployment rise is really just one more, I think, symptom of this underlying problem of class warfare, as you put it earlier, this real contempt for business.
Well, it is. It's an ecosystem of bad policy, contempt for business, contempt for wage earners, too, remember, because the highest state and marginal income rates are taxed to the people receiving a paycheck, not merely the people signing the paycheck. And so what you get is a decrease in demand because you have people that can't afford the housing and then don't have wage growth, don't have, there's too much of a regulatory apparatus that hurts the ability to get new jobs. That's really what we're talking about, is you have to have robust organic growth. And if you have some big embedded employers, you're on borrowed time. What you need, this is really, frankly, where the employment situation in New York has been so healthy. Dallas, Houston, those big cities have lost a lot of companies. They've lost a lot of jobs. They're just always able to replenish them, right? California is not doing that. The VC and biotech people that have left, they haven't been replaced by new ones. Where over the years, like New York's seen it, there's a lot less people that work in Wall Street now than there used to be, but they've added tech, they've added media, You have to diversify. Oil and gas doesn't employ the same amount of people in Texas, but they added so much in tech and medical and pharmaceutical and all these other industries. What is the growth sector for California? I mean, they're living off borrowed time.
Government, maybe, huh?
Well, there's still some big employers been around a while, but they're still moving. They're moving jobs out. My most recent Capital Record podcast, I had the guy who's the head of the Center for Economic Research and Forecasting. It had been out of UC Santa Barbara, and it moved and is incubated under Cal Lutheran University up in Thousand Oaks. And Amgen was the largest employer in Thousand Oaks. They've moved over half the jobs to Puerto Rico and other lower tax states. But then Westlake Village and Oxnard and the overall Ventura County area, they're suffering from very high housing prices with very low job growth creation. That is decimating to middle class. It's decimating to young people. It's decimating for future economic growth. And it's really good for Texas.
I love how you describe this as a kind of a regulatory ecosystem that is multi-causal, let's say, multivalent, as the social scientists like to say. Lots and lots of factors at play here that make this a very difficult state in which to do business. Here's a headline from, I think this is just run all over California now, this story, but here's the headline: state could derail BNSF, that's the big railroad company, Burlington Northern Santa Fe, $1.5 billion Barstow International Gateway. This is a project in Barstow that was designed to set up a kind of a rail hub outside of metropolitan Southern California, outside of Orange County, Long Beach, LA, that would take cargo traffic from that port area and move it by rail rather than by truck to get it off the freeways, get it out into Barstow, where it could be transferred into other kinds of rail and moved into the rest of the United States. So you're talking primarily about West Coast ports. And this project was going to be kind of the renaissance, a first birth, really, of this part of the high desert. We're talking about an area east of LA and west of the Nevada border that is really hungry for jobs. And you have lots and lots of people out there who could use this work and have had some marginal work in warehousing out there in the Inland Empire, San Bernardino, Riverside County, et cetera. And this project with the rail company, BNSF, was going to be huge. As it says here, $1.5 billion. But a new rule from the California Air Resource Board requiring the railroad operators to shift from diesel to all electric locomotives is the hurdle. This is the California Air Resources Board, or CARB. And so the speaker at a conference just last week talking about this whole project out in Barstow says that the CARB rule, she says, of the CARB rule, she says, I hate to tell everybody this, although we've been doing our best to test out electric locomotives, we do not have an electric locomotive that works. It's an impossible task for us to be able to do. So this, David, is part of that environmental push by Gavin Newsom that we've been talking about now for years. That is the just almost like Stalinist kind of bold declaration that in 5 years we will have no more fossil fuel burning. It's going to be all electric. It's totally arbitrary. It has nothing to do with science or engineering, just a kind of a utopian wish on the part of the progressive left and the governor. She says, BNSF's locomotives that are 23 years or older won't be able to operate in the state by 2030, even if they've been remanufactured and have brand new engines in them. The final kicker, she says, is starting in 2026, major railroads will be required to put up to $800 million each year into a fund that the state will manage so that when electric motors are available to be purchased, electric locomotives, I think is what the reporter means, are available to be purchased. It's the state that will go out and purchase them for the railroads with this fund. So putting the state in the position of acquiring your capital supplies, if you will, seems extraordinarily bizarre. But it's that idea that there is no electric solution yet for that heavy hauling diesel locomotive. We don't have a substitute, but the state insists they're going to have one anyway. And the state is willing to destroy the economy in order to produce this outcome.
Well, it's outrageous. And this is a really interesting pushback. I think that they are going to be able to generate a little public support for their side of this. And we'll see what gives. I mean, what the state did, it was so aggressive in what they're demanding. It's almost like they're expecting the pushback and they're planning to meet in the middle.
Hmm. You think?
I say that sometimes because I just have a hard time wrapping my arms around the irrationality of what I see from these people.
So you're hoping they're playing chess rather than just checkers? And
well, I'm not really hoping because I don't really care about these people at all. But I think that they might be playing checkers.
Fascinating. So they would create an unachievable goal and then negotiate down from that.
Yes.
Okay. That's fascinating. You heard it here first. Hey, you and I talked about this last story, gosh, I don't know, maybe a year or two ago. But here's the headline from the LA Times to give us the update on the conversation. Neil Young returns his music to Spotify. You probably saw this story, David. Neil Young, of course, you'll remember back a couple of years ago. I think it was 2022. Here it is. He objected, Neil Young did, to the fact that his music was on Spotify and so was Joe Rogan, and that Rogan was saying things that Neil Young didn't like about COVID, some of which may be lunatic. I don't know. I don't listen to Joe very often, but some of which may have been spot on. Like most of the garbage coming out of the CDC in Washington and Sacramento was dead wrong, and they now acknowledge it, but wave it off as saying, like, who could have known that young kids weren't going to get killed by COVID and that closing down schools would be devastating to learning. But now Neil Young's back, and he says in a statement, "My decision to return comes as services Apple and Amazon have started serving the same disinformation podcast features I'd opposed at Spotify." So he's back because he likes the money, I guess.
Well, he explained it. I mean, I would just take him at his own words. He said, "I pulled from Spotify and then just figured I'd go to Apple and Amazon, but now they're also allowing free speech. They're distributing other people that say things I disagree with. So if those people are going to do it, then I may as well just be with everyone who distributes stuff I don't agree with." That's what he said. Those are his words.
Yeah, it just looks like after a 2-year boycott, he's back on.
One thing you could do is say, "I never needed to boycott based on a platform distributing other people I disagree with. That I'm comfortable being distributed on a sort of digital marketplace that has other musicians that say stuff I like and other musicians say stuff I don't like, and comedians and interviewers and podcasters. And I'm going to try to wrap my arms around the fact that not everyone in the world agrees with me, and the consumers are out there just listening to different people, and I can't control it, even though I'm Neil freaking Young." But what the old man did is say, "No, I think I will only be at a place that everyone agrees with me, unless other places are also going to have people that disagree with me, in which case then I'm going to go to all places that have people that disagree with me." So it didn't seem like a real courageous coherent idea. And I don't even know, to be honest, it's about the money as much as the relevance. He was just going to be without distribution, period. Yeah.
Well, but this ties in so nicely to the theme with which we started, that was talking about art and its transgressive nature, which in fact ultimately isn't very transgressive at all. Here's Neil Young, radical anarchist out there doing his thing, living in California and making millions off music, but talking about, really, really being a transgressive artist. That's the whole persona, I think, with Neil Young and Crazy Horse and Buffalo Springfield, etc. It's fascinating to watch this, transgressive artist, Neil Young, whose music, by the way, I love. I am a huge fan of his music. But it is fascinating to watch the guy come down on the side of, "I'm going to try to shut up people I don't like by boycotting a platform," and then kind of coming back tail between legs. Hey, David, I've got a pre-recorded conversation here coming up with our mutual friend, Rick Reif. We were talking about opening day and specifically California's Winter League, which was the one place in the United States in the early 20th century where black teams could play white teams, a California Major League Baseball league that featured one black team and three white teams. They were not integrated teams, but it was a desegregated league in the sense you had black teams competing against white teams. And I know you are a huge baseball fan, but also a big March Madness fan, so this must be a very special time for you, David. How's March Madness looking for you?
My favorite team is still in it. My bracket is not, but I'm not in the bottom of the pack. I'm kind of in the middle. But you know, yeah, I do love college basketball. Those things like Yale upsetting Auburn and some the buzzer beater, you know, that got Colorado out of the first round, even though they did lose a really close game in the second round. Some overtime thrillers. There was a great game the other night with Oregon and Creighton. This is the best sports can be, is college basketball. It's the best sports can be. I'm not a huge baseball fan, Will, to be honest. I like baseball. But, you know, the whole start of the year when you got 462 games. Oh, wait, no, 162. though, I do think that this Otani story with the interpreter and the gambling, I don't think we've gotten the end of this story.
No, neither does Rick. Rick's going to talk about that in just a moment. And, of course, for me, the sports world only really truly begins in earnest when USC football kicks off late summer.
Yeah, we've had some good things going on in the offseason. I'm as still hurt and devastated by what took place last year as I've ever been in 49 years of loving USC football. But I am pleased. We've picked up some really, really good recruits, some good players, some good coaches. And that's all we do at USC is fight on. And for those of you that think when things go down that what you're supposed to do is give up, you should look into it a little bit.
I love the fight on spirit. Thanks for the reminder, David. All right. Well, I'll talk to you soon, but let's ask Sarah to go ahead and roll the interview with Rick Reif. All right. Welcome to Rick Reif, my friend, baseball fanatic, Pulitzer Prize winner, editor at large at the Orange County Business Journal. And you were there for years. That's how you and I met back when I was still a young commie and you were editor of the Orange County Business Journal and took a gamble on a young up and coming reporter and decided this was not the guy you needed covering banking and finance.
Well, you actually made that determination yourself. You were a brilliant young guy, but I think you made a wise choice rather than slave away as a banking writer. I think you chose a better career path.
I think I did too. I think everybody thanks me for that.
To not denigrate banking writers, of which I was one.
That's right. Someday we got to talk about your Pulitzer Prize, but we're here today to talk about baseball. You and I are recording on Monday, March the 25th, and opening day for Major League Baseball is Thursday, March 28th. And just before we get to a little bit of a caveat there, I want to point out that what we're really here to talk about, I just want to make sure we're not frightening away the distaff members or people who don't like baseball or sports talk, but there is a great social history coming up here in just one moment. But Rick, you had just before we got on, you were telling me that opening day is officially already open, even though really the regular season starts Thursday, March
Correct.
The 28th.
Thursday is the traditional opening day, but already there have been two games played in Korea. The two California teams, the Los Angeles Dodgers and the San Diego Padres, for the first time opened the baseball season, and they split. Dodgers won the first game. San Diego the next day won the second game. So this just shows, you know, baseball becoming more of an international game now, and there are more international players on the rosters. And in Asia, particularly in Japan and Korea, baseball very popular. And so this was a marketing move by Major League Baseball.
Well, let's talk real quickly. Again, this is not the socio-historical part of the show that we really want to get to, which is about the Winter League Baseball in California, which I think is going to be more tough evidence for the reparations folks up in Sacramento. But before we get to that, just you had an update on Shohei Ohtani. You were shocked that I didn't know anything about it. I hope, you know, regular listeners of the show will appreciate that. I was jet lagged most of last week, Rick. I just went to Germany, saw my new grandbaby. What a delight that was. Discovered that Germany is an awful lot uncomfortably like California and the United States more broadly. But talk to me about Shohei Ohtani, the Dodgers once in a generation.
Well, I think the last time I was on talking with you, Will, we were talking about the huge news that Ohtani made by signing a $700 million contract. So he, of course, has been the talk of the baseball offseason. And now he is continuing to be the talk, but probably now not for the reasons that he would like. his longtime interpreter is in hot water, and perhaps Shohei himself is in hot water, although we shall see. Ippai Mizuhara, If you have anybody, you don't even have to have watched baseball. If you've seen Shohei Ohtani speaking with the media, you've probably seen this gentleman next to Shohei. He has become his best friend. He was the catcher when Shohei was competing in the home run derby. I mean, he hangs around with Shohei all the time. And now it has come to light that he owed or owes $4.5 million in gambling debts. Some reporters started poking around and found out, holy cow, he owes $4.5 million. And he was paying either some of it or all of it from Shohei Ohtani's bank account. And Mizuhara, in an early interview after reporters started snooping around and asking questions, said he has a gambling addiction. He got in the hot water and Shohei graciously agreed to cover his debt. Shohei then, through his attorneys, announced no, Shohei did not cover his debts. Shohei has been the victim of a crime. The implication being that Mizuhara had embezzled the money, had access to Shohei's bank account, and he took the $4.5 million. So now, given kind of a lack of total candor on the part of some of the people involved and conflicting stories that have come out, it just so happens that within a couple of hours of us speaking here, Shohei is scheduled to talk to the media for the first time about this. He'll be at a press conference. Perhaps more will be revealed than we know right now. But
well, I'm wondering who will be his translator in this instance.
In this one, it's interesting. It's a staff member of the Dodgers, and the name did not appear to be a Japanese name. It looked like it was maybe a non-Japanese person who speaks Japanese, but that person will be acting as the interpreter for this press conference.
Fascinating. Well, Rick, I think, you know, for me, the highlight is less Shohei Ohtani and the Dodgers than it is Major League Baseball back in the over 100 years ago in what was then called the California Winter League. And you've done loads of research on this subject, but I wonder if you'll tell us about this. And the story for me is that at a time when Major League Baseball was deeply and profoundly segregated, and that most African-American ballplayers had to play in the Negro Leagues, as they were called back then, there was this one brief moment when black players got to play against white players. And let's not call it desegregated. I think, to be fair, these were segregated teams playing an integrated league. That is, that the teams, white teams, could play black teams, but that the rosters themselves, I believe, Rick, were not integrated.
Correct.
So give us the give us the deep history of California's Winter League.
This league is actually, it's fodder for both sides of the reparations debate. You could say that given the travails of this league and what they had to endure from the racism of organized baseball, that this was evidence of racism. On the other hand, California can lay claim to having been the first integrated league, and it started in 1910. Actually, the season of 1910-1911, because this was a winter league. So it started one year and ended the other year. And back then, some of the great Negro teams in the offseason would, as major league players do, go west. They would go west. They'd go south. They'd go west to California, where they could, continue to play if that's what they wanted to do in the offseason. And so in 1910, this was the first time that you had a league of four. It was in the Los Angeles, Southern California area. You had three white teams and one black team, and they played. And it was really owing to two interesting entrepreneurs. You had a nightclub owner named Joe Peroni, who had briefly been a minor league player, and he was quite a hustler, a man about town, and a black entrepreneur, Doc Anderson. And they decided, hey, this could be a good business. And so they went into business. And indeed, it was a very popular league, and it lasted until 1947. So virtually every season, I don't think there was any interruption. There might have been an interruption once or twice. But from 1910 to 1947, you had this integrated league. Now, They had some hurdles. The Pacific Coast League, which was the major, it was the biggest minor league, arguably in baseball, and it was the a California league, and they were part of the official organized baseball, and they wouldn't allow the black teams to play in Pacific Coast League parks. So that was a bit of a challenge. They had to play in smaller parks. Doc Anderson actually built a park so that his team had a place to play. And so they did encounter that. And white players were often discouraged. In fact, there was a ban on barnstorming that Judge Landis in Major League Baseball generally enforced. And so there was kind of a disincentive. Nonetheless, in the many years that league existed, here are some of the names of the greats that played. Let's start with some of the Negro players. Satchel Paige, Turkey Stearns, Smokey Joe Williams, Rube Foster, Buck Leonard. It goes on and on. Major leaguers, Stan Musial, Walter Johnson, Bob Feller, Jimmy Fox, Ted Williams. So you get a sense that there was integration going on in, albeit a limited way, but it was occurring in California.
Yeah, and that's what I think is most fascinating here is that, you know, while the national Major League Baseball was, you know, the American League, the National League, well, that they were deeply segregated. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that. Here in California, you had this fledgling attempt to kind of break that color barrier and allow these players to at least play against one another, if not on the same teams. You mentioned some of the names. Satchel Paige was in there. I don't know if you mentioned him, and Cool Papa Bell. Those are about the only names that I really recall from that era. But Walter Johnson of, I always get his name wrong. I hope that's, I got it right. Walter Johnson, the Orange County guy whose family moved here from the Midwest. He went to high school here in Orange County. He would frequently come out of the winter and play against black players, and he did really well. I mean, this guy, what do they call him? The Big Train?
The Big Train.
Yeah, he was like a football-sized tight end kind of guy who could really apparently hurl with the best of them. But you know, coming away from having faced black competition, declared that these guys were every bit the equal of the white players he played against in MLB. So, and I think that's what's fascinating, that, you know, yes, this can cut both ways on the reparations argument, but not on the California reparations argument, which has always declared that California was somehow so uniquely responsible for racist, segregationist behavior across the country that we owe our black neighbors and fellow Californians $1.2 million plus other things. This sort of, I think, you know, this is a uniquely California phenomenon, isn't it?
Yes, the only pushback I would give again is that the big league out here at the time was the Pacific Coast League, and perhaps it was because the pressure they were under from the rest of organized baseball, but they did draw a color line, and they you know, they were like all the other minor leagues that were, and as well as the major leagues, you know, had a color ban. But yes, to the extent there was any integration in baseball going on, it was going on in California.
That's right. And I would never, ever deny that racism isn't a feature of not all human beings, but many human beings in all places and at all times. There has been racism, and that certainly the Pacific Coast League was problematic. But this
one, and again, Will, to a point you've made often, even given that, that's not an argument for reparations. You know, the fact that there was you know, some ban going on back then. I mean, you know, there are many other arguments to be made against reparations, but clearly on California's, you know, a mitigating circumstance for California is that it operated for many, many years, the first and only integrated baseball league.
Now, you've actually, I think, been undertaking a separate research project on baseball in your own hometown, which is Laguna Beach, California, just south of where I am here in Irvine. And maybe you can tell us what you've discovered there. You've tracked down some really major league players.
Yes, for a number of years, even before I came to California, well, when I was a young man, a high schooler, reading the baseball encyclopedia, the first baseball encyclopedia that came up, and I'm leafing through the pages, And lo and behold, here's this guy, Gavi Cravath, that I'd never heard of. And there's all this black ink. You get black ink in the baseball encyclopedia when you've led the league in something, you know, doubles, triples, home runs, whatever. And this guy had black ink all over the place. And I'm saying, I never heard of him. Well, so that was the first, you know, and you file that away. Many years later, I'm living here in Southern California. I'm living in Laguna Beach. And this guy, Gavi Cravath, after his days as a baseball player, and I should say the most notable thing about Gavi Cravath, the baseball player, is that he was the greatest home run hitter in the history of baseball before Babe Ruth.
Mm.
His problem is that he was the greatest home run hitter before Babe Ruth, and that the numbers that Cravath and the other dead ball era players, they call it the dead ball because it was mushy and it had licorice and tobacco juice and everything else on it, and it was hard to hit home runs.
Mm-hmm.
And then they livened up the baseball, and Babe Ruth helped to liven up the baseball himself. And before you know it, people are hitting 40, 50, 60 home runs a year. And Cravath, who had the 20th century record before Babe Ruth, hit 24.
Hmm.
That doesn't look so good anymore. So mm-hmm. he's kind of forgotten, never made it to the Hall of Fame. I'm perhaps if I really get traction on this project, I may try to resuscitate an effort to get him in the Hall of Fame. But anyways, that's why he's famous as a baseball player. He retires. He goes back to Laguna Beach and he becomes the elected justice of the peace. And for decades, he was the elected judge of Laguna Beach. Also significant because he's the last judge in California who was not a member of the bar. He wasn't a lawyer. He didn't have a law degree. He was just a guy who got elected as the judge. And I believe, I'm not certain, but I believe he was grandfathered in at some point. Like, no, now you have to have a law degree to be a judge. But he got grandfathered, and he was a legend. He was a legend for his kind of homespun, folksy, crusty decisions from the bench. One time a guy came in, he wanted to file a suit. He said, Judge, this guy called me a son of a bitch. And Gavi Cravath said, well, you are a son of a bitch. And he dismissed the case. You know? So, I mean, he was a classic for doing things like that. He also had a historic case, usually as Justice of the Peace in Laguna Beach. You didn't get big cases, but during World War II, Franklin Roosevelt's daughter-in-law was stopped in Laguna Beach for speeding. And so she comes before Gavi, and Gavi apparently was very much a political conservative. He'd probably be listening to Radio Free California if he was around today. And so everybody thought, oh, Franklin Roosevelt's daughter, this is Gavi's chance to unload. And it's interesting. There was a board, and the name of it is escaping me. But it was the board that oversaw the ration coupons and all that. And it had tremendous power during World War II, you know, to make sure nobody was abusing it. People weren't cheating, stealing, you know, getting. And apparently, they even had control over gasoline. And anybody who got stopped on a citation was supposed to be brought to the attention of this federal body. And so everybody thought, oh, now Roosevelt's daughter is really in trouble. Gavi hears the case. He fines her for speeding. And he says, I'm not referring this case to the federal board. He says, I'm not a stool pigeon for the federal government.
Wow.
So, and then there was I saw this follow-up story where reporters are asking this federal body, you know, the people there, well, what are you going to do about it? They said, well, we never got a referral, so there's nothing that we can do. So that was the end of it. So that's Gavi Cravath, the judge. It gets even more interesting because one of his buddies was another former dead ball era baseball player by the name of Jimmy Austin. Jimmy Austin also lived in Laguna Beach. They used to hunt and fish in the off season because back then you could hunt and fish in Laguna Beach. And Jimmy is best known. If anybody has ever seen the iconic photo of Ty Cobb sliding into third base, and there's a third baseman jumping for his life, as you know, to avoid the spikes of Ty Cobb. That's Jimmy Austin. Well, Jimmy was a very popular guy in Laguna Beach, and he became the mayor of Laguna Beach. He was elected mayor. So in the 1940s, you had the judge and the mayor of Laguna Beach were both these well-known dead ball era baseball players, which I think is rather interesting.
It is rather interesting, Rick. Always interesting to talk to you about baseball or almost anything else. Well, anything else. But that's all the time we have today, and I want to thank our listeners for spending their time with us. You can always find Radio Free California on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe and, of course, rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe. That boosts our profile, and that helps others find and join this little band of brothers and sisters. Please email us your comments and story suggestions. You'll find our email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson and Rick Reif, we give thanks as ever to session producers Lucas Klaus, Brian Tong, and Glenn Hall, and to National Review podcast producer Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima.